This shir is dedicated by Usher and Bani Saban for the Refuah Shlema of Yoel ben Gittel Feiga. So, a Refuah Shlema. We are in Perek Yetet, chapter 19, Pasuk Chaf Tet, sentence 29. Further and further down the rabbit hole of this very difficult story. No way around it. We started out with the falling out between the Pilegesh and her non-husband, continuing with her going home and him coming after her finally, and her father wanting him to stay and trying to schmooze him and getting him to eat, and eventually they finally leave, and he just wants to get home as fast as possible. They go to a town that they say, well, this is a Jewish town, they're going to take care of us for sure, and of course it's not the way it works out. The people of the town are not happy with the safety of the guests is what I'll say, because we aren't able to determine definitively what their motivation is as they surround the house and they demand that the guests be released to them to be abused like Sodom, where you can read it. I think the logical way to read it is that they desired to abuse them. This was this was about them feeding their own appetites, as opposed to the story in Sodom, where we establish that it's part of a pattern of, we don't want guests here, we don't want to share. Those were the different schools of thought on what exactly motivated them, and we're going to talk about that more, but in the immediate context, we use that to try to explain why God doesn't destroy this town of Giv'ah the way that God destroys Sodom. We gave a few different answers. One answer is simply because God doesn't operate that way in this era. You're not seeing the same kind of open, visible miracle at this stage. That's one possibility. A second possibility that we floated, though, was that that these people are not as bad as Sodom. We noted Abarbanel's point. Abarbanel suggested this was just a gang. It's not the whole city, as opposed to in Sodom, where it's young to old. We gave different explanations. For more on that, you can catch the recordings from last week. But what we're up to now is the response to the brutality. And we already saw, in Pasuk Chaf Tet, in sentence 29, we read it at the end last time, that this fellow goes home carrying the body of his Pilegesh. He hacks up the body and sends pieces of the body around the country in order to rouse all of the Shvatim, all of the tribes, to come attack Giv'ah. That's what it looks like. He says, we have to act. And it would seem like he thought he had done nothing wrong in this story. Turning her over to the mob was something that he was not ashamed enough about that he wouldn't tell them the story, although it wasn't entirely clear what he told everybody. But the question I wanted to start with is this business of cutting her up in order to rally people. What in the world is that about? We have seen cutting off the heads of generals and warriors for display, right? Which stories do we know of in which that happens?
Goliath,
right, has his head cut off by David, and
Yael and Deborah.
So in the story with Yael killing Sisera, she puts a peg through his head. I don't think she cuts it off.
Oh.
I don't remember her cutting off his head. We'd have to go back and look at chapter 4, chapter 5, but I don't think she cuts off the head.
Right.
But we do have one other story, and it involves a woman. Not in Tanakh. In the Apocrypha. Judith cutting off the head of Holofernes. So we do have this idea, but that's not what's going on over here. Cutting them up as a message is just bizarre. So if you take a look at your sheet, at the first source, I brought you the only analogous case that I can really find. And I'm not the one who first found this. Professor Yechezkel Kaufman notes it. And that is a story from Shmuel Aleph, early in the reign of Shaul, very beginning of the reign of Shaul. The people of Yavesh Gilad are under threat by Ammon, and Shaul wants to rally the nation to the defense of Ammon. And we're told, Vayikach Tzemed Bakar, he took a yoke of oxen, Vayinatcheyu, and he cut it up. Vayishalach Bechol Gvul Yisrael Biyad HaMalachim, and he sent them all around Israel via agents, Lemor, with the following message. Ashereinenu Yotzei Acharei Shaul V'Achar Shmuel. If anybody doesn't go to war with Shaul and Shmuel, Ko Yeyaseh Livkaro. This is what's going to happen to his cattle. Vayipol Pachad Hashem Ala'am V'Yetzu Ki Yish Echad. And everybody comes out to war at that point. Everybody listens. So you have the idea there, and that story may be not long after this one, depending on our age-old debate about when this story took place. But we have a practice of summoning people by cutting something up. And effectively, you could argue that this is part of the excesses that take place when you don't have a leader. Shaul cuts up an animal to send out the parts. This fellow cuts up a human being, right? Flying in the face of everything that we talk about in the Torah. I mean, the way you handle a body. So yes, and we had this conversation a while back when we first started the story about Ramah and Giva. I don't remember if you were there that week, but we talked about how he turns down going to the city of Ramah, saying Giva is going to be a good place for me. Ramah is the place that Shmuel is from, and Giva is the place that Shaul is from. We even talked about the suggestion that this story is an anti-Shaul polemic. It's brought here to say, look where Shaul comes from. But that's very weak. As Kaufman noted in addressing that, it's inconsistent with the Tanakh's treatment of Shaul.
Right. No, but based on that, the fact that the person with the Pelegesh used that to get everyone to rally against Givat, and now Shaul is throwing it in their face, not as dramatic, but using that to rally to get everyone to come back.
Right. It's an interesting point. It's an interesting point. I haven't seen anybody pick up on it, but it is an interesting point. Okay. So the only other thing I did want to note related to this method is in source number 2, Lucian of Samosata talks about a custom in his day, and I wrote in there, it's 2nd century Greece, so it's long after this story. But they have what he calls a custom of the hide. Our custom of the hide is as follows. When a man has been injured by another and desires vengeance, but feels that he is no match for his opponent, he sacrifices an ox, cuts up the flesh and cooks it, and spreads out the hide upon the ground. On this hide he takes his seat, holding his hands behind him so as to suggest that his arms are tied in that position, this being the natural attitude of a suppliant among us. Meanwhile, the flesh of the ox has been laid out, and the man's relations and any others who feel so disposed come up and take a portion thereof, and setting their right foot on the hide, promise whatever assistance is in their power. One will engage to furnish and maintain 5 horsemen, another 1 10, a third some larger number, while others, according to their ability, promise heavier light-armed infantry, and so on. So they assemble on the hide, and take these pieces of meat. So this I saw quoted by a Christian commentary to this perek to say, well, maybe there's some association there. I'm less convinced. I think that what you're really meant to see here is exactly what it looks like when you first read the story, which is, this is barbaric. This is inconsistent with halacha in terms of burial practices. This is something that demonstrates once again, Ein Melech b'Yisrael. There is no king in Israel, and Ish HaYashar be'einav ya'aseh. People do whatever is right in their eyes. So to him, what's right is to rally people. We got to do something about this, and he's just going to do whatever comes to mind. And this is, you know, what came to mind for him. That plus the ill treatment of the concubine herself, which is consistent with what we've been imagining all along. his attitude to her is, as demonstrated by him throwing her out of the house that night in the first place. Okay. So he says to the recipients of his message, it's in Pasuk Lamed, V'haya kol haro'eh, all who see this, these parts of her body, V'amar lo nihyasa v'lo nirasa kazos l'miyom alos b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim ad hayom hazeh. They're going to say, this, such a thing, not the cutting up, but the original event, nothing like this has happened since the day we left Egypt. We've never descended that low. Simu lachem aleha utzu v'daberu. So set yourself to do something about it. So what does the nation do in response? Let's take a look at the opening psukim. The opening sentences in Perek Chaf. Vayetzu kol b'nei Yisrael. All of Israel went out. Vatikohel ha'eda ki ish echad. The nation gathers as one. Lemidan ve'ad be'er sheva. From Dan, which of course we know is in the north. That was the last story. To Be'er Sheva in the south. That becomes a phrase that the Gemara uses when it wants to speak about the entire span of the land of Israel. It says, from Dan to Be'er Sheva. Ve'eretz ha-Gil'ad, as well as the land of the Gil'ad. Where is the land of the Gil'ad?
The east side of the Jordan?
Yeah, east of the Yarden, correct. The land of Menashe. El Hashem, they gather to God, HaMitzpah, in this place called Mitzpah. Now, there are a lot of places called Mitzpah. We're going to have to talk about this Mitzpah and what this one is. Mitzpah is just an outlook, right? A lookout. You could identify lots of places as Mitzpah, so we're going to have to deal with that. But just to look at Pasuk Bet first, sentence 2, Vayisyatzvu pinos kol ha'am, kol shivtei Yisrael. Some of you have English translations there. How do your translations render the word pinot, pinot kol ha'am, in sentence 2?
Leaders.
Sorry?
Leaders.
So they take the view that you have one that says leaders. Okay, that's taking the view that that Rashi does, and Radak mentions it as well. Anybody have anything else?
Chiefs.
I'm sorry?
Chiefs.
Say it again?
Chiefs.
Chiefs. Okay, chiefs and leaders are the same thing for our purposes. I'm going to show you a couple of other ways to take it in a minute. Kol Shivtei Yisrael, all the tribes of Israel, of course, minus Binyamin. Bikahal Am HaElokim, all assembled, the nation of God, Arba Meos Elef Ish Ragli Sholef Charev. 400,000 swordsmen are ready to act on what has happened. So, there's a lot that we need to talk about, even in just these two sentences. There's some strange things going on here. There are some interesting linguistic things happening here as well, in this. Notice that they are identified as Am Elokim, right? The nation of God. So the Malbim says it means to say they come out of zealousness for God. That's why they are there. They have swords. Isn't that interesting? Why is it interesting that they have swords?
Because the Jews weren't able to make swords.
Yeah. All through Sefer Shoftim, we've been using makeshift weapons. Right? From the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, it's been a case of using whatever it was that we had at hand. Suddenly, we've got real weapons. And who are we going to wield them against? Other Jews. Right? We're going to fight the Plishtim. We're going to use a jawbone of a donkey or the tails of foxes holding torches. We're going to fight, actually those were Plishtim also, Shamgar's enemies, with a cattle goad. Right? Yael is going to kill Sisera using a tent peg. We get swords? Cool. Now we can attack other Jews. It's a really striking thing. There's more going on here that's fascinating. Professor Kaufman notes that right now they don't actually have the entire nation, even though it sounds like they do. In chapter 21, they're going to swear an oath and demand that everybody actually show up. So not everybody is here yet, but 400,000 is a nice number. I want to go back, though, to this place of Mitzpah. That's a really interesting place. for them to gather. Sorry?
Can we go back to swords for a second?
Yeah.
If this occurred at the beginning of Shoftim,
yeah,
it's difficult to understand how all of a sudden all the swords disappear.
Unless, what would be the answer? You're right, but what's the answer? The answer would be those who controlled us took them away. Meaning we're going to find in Shmuel that the Plishtim specifically act to confiscate all weapons and to make it impossible to create them. So it's not beyond thought that they had in the beginning. I mean, I'm in the camp of those who argue that that this story happened early on and it's transplanted to the end. But you could go with those who put it at the end if you wanted to. But the alternative is to say it's not from the end; it's actually from the beginning, and the nations we served, Moab, Ammon, each one in its own turn, confiscated weapons and made it very difficult for Jews to wield them. I want to know why they're in Mitzpah. Go back to the pasuk. Go back to the end of sentence one. Did you notice it didn't just say they came to Mitzpah? What did it say?
For Hashem and Mitzpah.
Yeah. They gathered before God in Mitzpah. What does that mean? Where is God? That's a philosophical question. But where is God in these stories in Tanakh? Sorry?
Shiloh.
God is in the Mishkan. Right? When you go before God, you go to the Mishkan. So how are you before God in Mitzpah?
Where was the Aron?
The Aron is in the Mishkan. It's very odd that they're gathering before God in Mitzpah. This is very strange. So take a look at your sheet, where I offer you a couple of suggestions. The first suggestion is Radak commenting on our text. He says, "B'makom sheyiskabtzu kol Yisrael o rubam, sham shchina shorah." Wherever the Jews gather as a whole, or the majority of the Jews gather, that is where the Shechina is. So they're gathering before God in the sense that they're all gathered. That's one. That's one possibility. Give me another possibility. So maybe it's near Shiloh. In fact, there is a possibility of Mitzpah being near Shiloh, because we find that in Sefer Shmuel. We find that that when the report comes in Shmuel Aleph Perek Dalet, the report comes in that they've lost the Aron in their war with the Plishtim. Eli HaKohen is out looking, waiting for the report to come in. If I remember correctly. Well, you know what? I don't need to remember correctly because I'm doing this on my computer. So I can just ask my computer if it remembers correctly. Hang on. I believe he is sitting in Mitzpah. Yes, Vayavo. It's chapter 4, sentence 13. So David is correct. Vayavo v'hine Eli yoshev al hakisei yad derech. Actually, Mitzapeh. Mitzapeh. He is looking out. He's by the road, looking out. I'm just looking at the commentators there. It's a verb. So, sorry, David. It would have been really good, though, if there had been a mitzvah there. That would have been very clever. But in any case, a second approach is brought by Radak elsewhere. Radak, back in Sefer Yehoshua, there is a place called Mitzvah where the Jews gathered after initial battles with the nations in Canaan. Take a look at what Radak says. Because there's a lot of text, I'm just going to read my English translation. Perhaps this place is the Mitzpah where Israel always gathered. Because a great salvation happened there, they would meet there. Meaning, after every war, the Jews would come back to Mitzpah. In the other war, Yoshua fought against the five kings. Although there was a great salvation, there were only five kings. These were many kings, and that's why it became the place for the Jews to gather. And then he goes on to say, It is also possible that Yahushua built an altar there because of the great salvation that happened there, their great victory, and therefore Israel gathered there when they needed to do so for war or some other great matter. It became a place to go. And so we see with Yiftach, he was before God in Mitzpah, and the concubine Agiva, our story to God in Mitzpah. And so declared Shmuel in the war with the Plishtim, gather to me all Israel to Mitzpah. And then he says, I'll daven for them. And so when he coronated Shaul, Shmuel called the nation to God to Mitzpah. From all of these verses, it appears that there was an altar there and a house sanctified for prayer and for the gatherings of Israel in those days. So the idea here is, the idea of the Mitzpah, as Radak sees it, is it was a particular lookout that the Jews used over time. That's where Shaul was coronated. That's where Yahushua had won a great victory. That's what we are doing here. And if you take a look at source number 5 on your sheet, you'll see Abarbanel say the same thing. Abarbanel says, and then Chuck, I'll take your comment at that point. Abarbanel says, Yan hayabi dehem devar mikubal. They had a tradition. That Hashem's attention will be fastened to the nation, specifically in Mitzpah. Because that's where Yahushua won his battle against the kings who were assembled against him. Visham haya mizbeach ubeit tefillah. You had a mizbeach there, you had a place to daven there. And that's where the Jews would gather. So Radak and Abarbanel float a different answer. It's interesting that Radak on our pasuk doesn't say it. Radak on our pasuk said it's before God because wherever the Jews gather is where God is, which is a very nice answer. But that's not his original answer. His original answer, which he wrote in Yahushua, which you saw in source number 4, which Abarbanel echoes here, is that the Jews gathered to a place of historical significance. This is where we gather for big things, because this is a big deal. Now, Chuck notes the idea of Mitzpah as a lookout, a watchtower, as he quotes here, and he's quoting somebody who says, a place in Gilad north of Yabok and location of Laban's cairn, because the pasuk there says, "Va'mitzpah sharamar yitzef Hashem beini uveinecho," when Yaakov and Laban make their deal and they have this pile of stones, also known indeed as a cairn, which is a cooler sounding word than pile of stones. A place in Gilad, south of Yabok, site unknown, a place near Mount Hermon. You immediately see that we have a problem, of course, because there are too many locations. The word mitzpah, as I said before, is a generic word. There are lots of lookouts. And you can take the view that this is just a lookout and has no significance. Only that the Jews are gathering there now and that makes it significant. Or you take the view that this was a particular mitzpah where they gathered. Clear? Okay. Pinot kol ha'am. So we ask the question of what does pinot kol ha'am mean? And I got the answer that people's translations say the leaders of the nation or the chiefs of the nation, which is really the same thing. And that's Rashi. Rashi gives that that answer, right? If you take a look at source number 8, I didn't translate it on the sheet because I saw I had 3 even pages and said, okay, let me just stick to that. But Rashi says, Pinot kol ha'am, reshei kol amo. He's quoting the Targum on it, the heads of the entire nation. That's Rashi's answer. By the way, because this is one of my favorites in terms of words in Tanakh that people mistranslate, God willing, on Thursday morning, we will say Hallel, and I believe the province is even allowing us to still say it with a minyan. As long as you're not in an outdoor gathering, religious services are still okay. So the Evan Masua Bonim Haita Larosh Pina. So I grew up hearing that means the stone that had been rejected by the builders became Rosh Pina, became the head cornerstone. That's what I grew up hearing, because Pina is a corner. However, that is almost certainly not what the Pasuk means. Pina is often used in Tanakh to describe something that is up high and very visible, which makes sense in the pasuk. right? Hayta la rosh pina. If it's a cornerstone is where? High or low? Low. It's at the bottom. Right. Rosh pina doesn't make any sense if pina means cornerstone. It's davka, the top, that we're talking about. And I can bring you a lot of proof for this. In Nehemiah, in Tehillim, even a pasuk in Parshas Truma. Bless you. So Rashi says, Pina is the leadership. That's what's going on here. That's Rashi's position. However, Ramban and Abarbanel give other explanations. Go back to source number 6, where Ramban says, V'hine pinot kol ha'am mikol shivtei Yisrael ratzu la'asot geder gadol badavar. He says, pinot kol ha'am. The truth is, he doesn't actually... I'm assuming, maybe Ramban means what Rashi means. I'm not so sure of the... I'm not so sure I'm right suddenly. But I assumed when Ramban said this, he meant corners. The corners of the nation from all of the tribes of Israel, not the leaders of the tribes. I thought he meant pina, like corner, which I do know, and I can say, Abarbanel is of the belief that pina is a corner, and it's not just Abarbanel, but Metzudat David and Malbim as well. He takes corner as well, but he says what it means is, Behikavetz amim yachdav, pinot. He says, when the nations, it means the populations of the Jewish people, the tribes, gather, each one is in its own corner. Each one is in its own corner, its own space, separate from the others. So in other words, to try to link all of this together, Rashi says that it's the leaders of the nation. Ramban might be with Rashi that it's the leaders, or he might be saying they gathered from all the corners. And then you have a third possibility, Abarbanel, that it's each tribe sitting in its own space. A lot of different possibilities. Taking the approach that it's... that each sitting in its own space, it gives you a little bit of a sense of division, which is interesting because they're all going to bond together in this story. But what I find most striking here is actually not the word pinot, but rather the word kol. Right? The idea that everybody is rallying together to be a part of this. All of the tribes are going to be involved. They take this very, very seriously. And I find that to be striking because it reminds me that this is not our first attempt in Sefer Shoftim to bring the entire nation together, right? Who else tried to rally the whole nation to war? In Sefer Shoftim. Sorry? So Yiftach is actually somebody who wants to do it himself, right? They summon Yiftach to be the one to lead them in battle. I don't remember Yiftach pushing for the nation to come out.
Devorah,
right? And she's very angry in her poem about the tribes that didn't bother to show up. And who else? We got one more at least. Gidon. Right? Gidon also tried to rally the entire nation. Remember, he has this whole business going where Ephraim is angry and he didn't call us, and he, of course, did call them. We have figures who tried to rally everybody to help the Jews fight off an enemy, and they were not successful in getting the Jews to do it. I'm reading with Yiftach, and I don't see Yiftach actually summon the nation. Gidon tries it, and Devorah tries it, and they're not successful. Here, it's a fight of Jews against other Jews, and suddenly everybody turns up. Hopefully it's just a measure of how horrified they were, and it's not that, okay, this is a fight with other Jews, and therefore we're all going to be there. But...
I'm surprised that no one sided with Binyamin.
Sorry?
find it surprising?
Do I find it surprising that nobody sided with Binyamin? So Binyamin will find it surprising that no one sides with Binyamin. Ramban is going to find it surprising that no one sides with Binyamin. But I don't find it surprising. I mean, I really don't want to go near anything political, so I'm telling you right now, no one say anything political. Thank you. But when this kind of a thing takes place in Giv'ah, you would expect a unified response from the nation. You don't look for people to defend Binyamin.
It's not that they would have defended them on a moral basis, but I would presume that there was still alliances among the tribes that was left over from the schism between Joseph's sons and Joseph's side and the other side.
So, it's an interesting thought. Binyamin ends up being close allies with Yehuda. When the northern tribes split off, Binyamin is the one to remain with Yehuda, which is obviously centuries after this. I don't know, I shouldn't say that. It all depends on when this story happens. If this story happens at the end of Shoftim, it's less than a century later that they're going to split off. So it all depends on where this story is placed. But no one's going to come to the rescue of Binyamin. No one's going to defend Binyamin until they're almost gone.
But that's also a universal thing. I'm just wondering, they're tribes.
Yeah.
There are alliances.
Yep.
As much as they're part of Klal Yisrael, there are different alliances in all the way through here.
Yeah. Right.
I found that a surprising part of the story.
Okay. So let's see where it goes. Other questions and comments on this? Okay. Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. Just getting back to the page again. Vayishme'u b'nei Binyamin ki alu b'nei Yisrael ha-mitzpah. So the Jews hear, Binyamin hears, that the Jews have ascended to Mitzpah. Vayomru b'nei Yisrael, dabru eicha nehiyasa hara'a hazos. We get this opening half sentence that says Binyamin knows what's going on, and then we immediately jump back to what the tribes are doing. Right? What are the tribes doing? They immediately turn to this fellow, the non-husband, and say to him, how in the world did this terrible thing happen? Tell us the story. So most commentators assume that that when we say here, Binyamin heard, what we mean is Binyamin heard and did nothing. And that's why the other tribes need to act. Because Binyamin, what they should have done, is brought judgment against Giv'ah themselves. And the fact that they don't do that is what then leads to what comes next. That's the way most commentators read it. But take a look on your sheet at Abarbanel. Source number 9, please. Abarbanel writes, Ulufi sheze yisaper achakach ech shalchu aleihem b'nei Yisrael malachim v'lo shemu aleihem b'nei Binyamin. The text is going to tell us that the tribes send messengers to Binyamin saying, hey, turn over Giv'ah, and they don't do it. Achshov sheperush vayishme'u b'nei Binyamin ushenizkabtzu heim b'neihem lefish nizkabtzu b'nei Yisrael. He says vayishme'u does not mean and they heard. Rather, it means that they rallied. They saw all these other tribes getting together in Mitzpah, and they said, we better gather as well. When Shaul fights against Amalek, it says he gathers the nation, vayishama. He summons them. So they are summoning themselves. Yisapera kasuv shemiyad sheYisrael neesfu b'mitzpah niskabtu gam kin b'nei Binyamin kulam be'areihem. What the text is informing us is that immediately when Israel gathered in Mitzpah, Binyamin gathered in their cities. Indicating they knew what had happened. And they gathered for defense purposes. So the way that most read this, it's really interesting. The way that most read that half line about Binyamin is Binyamin did nothing. They heard and did nothing. Abarbanel says, no, they heard and they rallied to defend themselves against the other tribes. You follow? Two opposite reads, both negative, but two opposite reads of what it was that that Binyamin did. The other tribes say, tell us what happened. Vayan ha'ish ha'levi. So the Levi answers. That's a good name for him. That's better than the non-husband name. The Levi answers. Ish ha'isha ha'nirtzacha, the man of the woman who was killed. Right? Now suddenly he's a husband. Right? Took him a while. Suddenly he's a husband. He's been an adon. He's been a baal. Now he's an ish. Vayomar, and he said, Hagivasa asher levinyamin basi anu filagshi lalun. That Pilegesh and I came to Giv'ah in Binyamin to spend the night. Vayakumu alai balea Giv'ah vayasobu alai es habayis laila. And the people of Giv'ah rose up against me. They surrounded the house at night. Osi dimu laharog. They said they were going to kill me. Ve'es pilagshi inu, and they tortured my pilagesh. He conveniently skips how she got out of the house. Vatamos, and she died. That's my version of the story, he says. I took hold of my pilagesh. Va'anatcheha, I cut her up. Va'ashalcheha b'chol sdei nachlas Yisrael, and I sent her throughout the portions of Israel. Kiasu zima unvala b'Yisrael, because they did this terrible thing in Israel. And he concludes, Hine chulchem b'nei Yisrael havu lachem davar ve'etza halom. You tell me what to do, he says. I want all of you to give counsel as to what ought to happen at this stage. Interesting. Thoughts? Straightforward?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Where was the probing and verifying the veracity of the story? Where was, let's hear from Binyamin on the other side. And no. I don't know if it would have been different. Don't forget, women were chattels, right? So he
says
gave
who?
Her away.
I'm stuck on the don't forget part. Says who?
Let me throw it back. Were women not chattels at that time?
I see nothing here that...
Were they treated as assets? Were
only the sold? Only the Pilegesh. Now, I'm being very serious. Meaning, the way that women are presented in Sefer Shoftim, right, and there aren't that many to begin with, right? You know, you don't have too many. But I go back to the women who we have mentioned, who may stand out because they're the women we've mentioned, and therefore they may not be a representative sample. But we have Manoach's mother. The Philistine women don't count. We have Yiftach's daughter. We have... Who else? Well, obviously Devorah. Yael doesn't count. Right, because Yael, according to most reads, and we discussed this, you know, it seems not to be from the Jews. I see a lot of people frozen. At first, I thought everyone was wrapped. Now I'm starting to wonder. Am I audible?
Where you said we have Manoah's mother?
Okay, we have Shimshon's mother. We have Yiftach's daughter, Devorah. You don't have too many women in the story, is the bottom line, in order to really get a picture of it.
But if you go through each one,
yeah.
Manoah's wife didn't have a name. Yiftach's daughter...
Manoah's wife's name is Hatzla Ponit. Next?
Not in the text. That comes later.
Yes.
Okay. She certainly had a name, but she wasn't given a name. If the daughter was given, she had no choice in being sacrificed.
Actually, no. She's Deborah, a... One second, back Deborah, up. Back up, because that's not what the story says. It says that she insists on being sacrificed. She says to her father, you have to do what you promised. Yes, but look at what look at the preceding line. The preceding line says she told him you have to fulfill your vow. You can't skip a sentence. she said you have to fulfill the vow. He wasn't going to do it. I don't think that the assumption of their chattel is supported by the evidence. I think the Pelegesh is chattel. And I think that's why her father wants to make nice to the guy who bought her. But I don't think I don't think it's fair to make the statement that they're chattel in general.
But the point was, she was chattel.
Yes.
He gave her away.
Yes.
And I don't know how they would have reacted in the same way if that was part of the story, if that would have been part of the evidence before them.
What do you mean? They knew. She's a Pelegesh. He said it explicitly.
No, my point, Rabbi, is if I have an ox,
yeah,
and I give it to my friend does what he wants with the ox, and I don't have a say about it. I give it away.
Yeah.
Is that what happened here? Did he give away his Pelegesh?
No. If that were true, then why would they be angry at Binyamin?
Because they don't know about it.
He said it explicitly.
He said, they took my Pelegesh.
Oh, you're saying that if he had said that he sent her out? I think that's a very interesting piece of speculation. I don't think it's supported. Especially because if he tells them that, he also tells them they threatened they were going to kill me, and that's why I sent her out. That's not a gift in any system. I wouldn't read it that way.
No,
and I think the fact that they all rally and nobody says to him, it's just a Pelegesh, speaks against you.
If somebody steals my object and I have Yeush, and he takes there's a level of ownership there.
No, there isn't. Only in the sense that he's responsible to restore it to me in the condition it was in when he stole it, or to pay me for the difference in value. I think you're fighting a losing battle here. You're a lawyer. You like doing that. But I don't think you have enough evidence to support the position here. The fact that they get so upset speaks to the fact that this was not acceptable to them. They certainly know she's a Pelegesh because he says so. So
My point was never that she had a diminished status that made it okay. My point was, if she was a piece of chattel and he gave her away as a piece of chattel that he didn't have ownership for, they didn't tell him, give us the woman or we'll hurt you. He did that voluntarily so that they would hurt her as opposed to him. That was not evident here. There's a difference if at the end of the day they'll turn and say a plague on both your houses, or opposed to, you were victimized, your wife slash...
Right, I understand what you're saying, but it's entirely speculative. We have no... I can't deal in a what if. They don't hear that piece of the story. They don't hear that he sent her out. I think he hides it because it's not the sort of villainy that you want to disclose to all these people. And they act. How would they have reacted if he had included that piece of information? I don't know. We don't have information to work with. I'm just not willing to make the assumption that they would have been fine with it, because aside from the fact that it wouldn't have been a proper transaction, he's doing it under duress. It doesn't fit, and it wouldn't have been acceptable as conduct to the Pelegesh, even to the concubine. There's no universe in which this becomes acceptable. That's my sense of it. I'm not even giving them the benefit of the doubt, because remember, this is the nadir of Jewish history. Like, if they can go bad, they will. I don't see any evidence to support the idea that they would have accepted this kind of treatment of her. So, in this story, right, he tells them what had happened. Malbim reads the story as him actually trying to make it sound as bad as possible. You might have missed it. If you take a look back at Pasuk Hey at sentence 5, he says, Vayakumu alai ba'alei ha-giv'ah. Ba'alei ha-giv'ah, the people in charge of Giv'ah, are the ones who did it. Remember that Abarbanel believed that, I'm sorry, Abarbanel, Malbim believed that, no, it was Abarbanel, that it wasn't the leaders, it was a gang. So Malbim suggests that here he's trying to play it up as being the leaders. Look how bad they are. Look what they did. You follow? He says, look, it was the leaders that came and did this. So the nation responds. Pasuk Tet. Vayakom kol ha Pasuk Chedesh. No, Pasuk Tet. Vayakom kol ha'am ki ish echad le'mor. They got up ki ish echad, as one man, saying, Lo ne'lech ish le'ohalo, nobody is going home. Velo nasur ish le'beiso, nobody is going back. Ve'ata zeh ha'davar asher na'aseh la'giv'ah. Here's what we are going to do to the people of Giv'ah. Aleha begoral. We are going to go against Giv'ah by lottery. What do you mean? Ve'lakachnu asaran Hashem lema'ah l'chol shivtei Yisrael. 10% of all the tribes of Israel, 10 out of 100, umay Allah elef, and in case people didn't know how to do math, the decimal system was a little new back then, 100 out of 1,000, the elef laravava, and 100 out of 1,000, lakachas tzedah la'am, that percentage, the 10%, are going to be the ones who are going to furnish supplies for those who are going to for those who are going to fight. La'asos levo'am legeva bin yamin kechol hanevalah asher asa b'Yisrael, to visit upon Giv'ah that which they did to her. Ve'yaseif kol ish Yisrael el ha'ir ki ish echad chaverim. And this is the difference between pinos kol ha'am according to Abarbanel, where everybody was in their own corner. Now everybody is assembled and ready to act as chaverim. We are all allies. Thoughts on those last few psukim? I've got questions. No one has questions about these last few psukim? Nothing here is strange? Yeah.
What's it doing there?
Right. Why? I mean, once you say 10 out of 100, I'm pretty good, right? I can do the rest. Why do you need to spell out the math? Why do you need to spell out the support system at all? Where do we ever find a war in which we are told that this is the way we're going to take care of things? Here are the logistics, right? It's Miller Bernstein, Fred. Right, the Miller Bernstein piece of the Jews going to war. We're going to figure out the logistics. We've got this percentage. They're going to support everybody else. Like, you don't need that. Just tell me, tell me again about their weapons. Like, give me that kind of information. I don't need to know the infrastructure. That's one problem. Second question: what's with the lottery? Why are we deciding this by lottery? Why do I have a way to do this? Let's take the guys who are skinny, right, and say, you guys are the ones to furnish supplies for all the other warriors. Why are we, doing this by lottery?
I take a look at this and I see that everybody wants to be part of it. That it was so universal that they had to take a lottery to give the people a choice. So it's like,
Yeah.
everybody had to have their turn. Everybody had to participating.
Right.
That's the message that I got.
Right. So Chuck says, and I think it's a very reasonable statement, that everybody wants to go. So this way, we're going to do it in a fair way. We do it by lottery. That's certainly one option. I'll offer you another thought, though. We use lotteries in various places in Tanakh. Where else do we use lotteries? I realize my signal is breaking up here.
Yom Kippur,
right? The Seir Lashem, Seir Lazazel, right? The two goats. Right. So I didn't hear the first half of what you said, but I heard the ending, and the ending is the key. Right. Lotteries in Tanakh are very often calling upon God to adjudicate something. God should be the one to declare it. We did it. Yoshua does it with the lottery to figure out who took from the spoils of Yericho. They do it when they divide up the land. We talked about that in Yoshua, even though they know who's supposed to go where. They did it in the beginning of Shoftim, the question of who should fight first, right? And the Goral fell on Yehuda. We do it in Tanakh in general. The goal of having a lottery is in order to say, I am hands off, this is up to God. Perhaps because, as Chuck said, everybody wants to fight. And perhaps it's not about everybody wanting to fight, but it's it's simply a statement of we want God part of our effort. Another piece of it. Yes, Howie.
Okay, so I'm having some difficulty here in that we started off saying this is a time that there wasn't kings.
Yeah.
And we wanted to show the benefit of a king.
Yeah.
And when you keep on saying that these people have done, they're doing God's will, they're having the lottery to do God's will, and everything is God's will, that defeats the concept that we need a king, because...
Did we say everything was God's will? Where did we invoke God other than the lottery?
Well, you're saying they went to Mitzvah.
Right, where Jews had historically gathered, that's true.
Okay, so again, they're having... It's showing they have the right intent when they're doing this, which I disagree with. But the Pesukim appear to be saying that.
So...
That they all gathered as one, they were united. And there's all these things here that show a lack of a need for a king. Because Bnei Israel was able to get fully united, and now it says they're Chavei Brim.
So what I see here is much like what we identified in the story of Pesel Micha, which is a nation with a split identity. On the one hand, they're wild and lawless, and they cut up the body of the Pelegesh in order to summon everybody to battle. And on the other hand, when they do go to battle, they gather in this place where God has brought them victories in the past. They have the mechanisms. They have the lottery system. Yeah, they're functional. They're functionally illiterate. They're doing, but they don't really understand and embrace the ideas that are behind it. Not unlike what we saw in Pesel Micha, right? Where Micha is thrilled. Now I have a Levi to serve as a Kohen in my quasi-idolatrous house of worship. You know, this is who they are. It's bizarre. Whereas in the story of Pesel Micha, it comes off as funny. Here it ends up being catastrophic. But that's who they are. That's what I see. It's hard. I'd like to do that at more of a conversation, but I'm getting a lot of breaking up of the sound here because my connection is poor this evening for some reason. I think probably everybody on my block is at this point home and on the internet all the time. But the other thing I wanted to make sure to note in this is that emphasis on the support system. Take a look at Ralbag, please, in source number 10. Ralbag writes, Ulman yuchlu lihisakev sham ad biaram hara shalchu asiris hamachne lakachas tzedala'am. He says they send 10% of the camp to go get supplies in order to make sure they'd be able to do this as a long war as needed. We're going to take care of this as long as it takes. to me, that's why you're emphasizing the math and the support system. To show the thought that went into this, the people are ready to do this, whatever it takes, whatever they have to do, in order to get rid of what they perceive as being evil. That's the idea. Abarbanel comments here, if you take a look at source number 11, I made the point before, but now I'll just highlight it for you. You can see it here. Abarbanel says, Ki ish echad chaverim, as one, they are allies. Rotza lomar lo be'erech hayosam shvatim nifradim. They're not coming in as separate tribes. Avo behiyosam ki ish echad chaverim. They are as one, they are allies. She'ish el re'eu ya'azoru, each one will help the next. They're all in it together. They're allied. They're not separate. Everybody is unified in this desire to make sure that justice is carried out against Giv'ah and what ends up being the war against Binyamin. So there's a lot more to say here. A lot more. There's even one source I'm leaving in number 12. I'm going to hold that for next time. But we now have the nation assembled. Binyamin is not interested in diplomacy, and we'll see where things go from here. Binyamin knows they're gathering, right? We saw that. But we're not going to see any diplomacy at all between them. All right?
What should have happened?
So that's a question we're going to get into, because Ramban and Malbim are going to be very into that question. There are two schools, but we'll see it play out. One school is, what should have happened is that the tribes should have gone to Binyamin and said, step back. What should have happened is Binyamin should have taken care of it among themselves. Each Shevet is supposed to worry about what's going on in their borders, and Binyamin should have been the one to take care of it. The only question between the commentators and the different camps is, what should have happened when Binyamin did not take care of it? Is it time for all the tribes to step in? Or do you step back and say, this is Binyamin's affair? So that we're going to have to see.